You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And we've got a lot of science with us today, for us today, from our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, who is joining us for another week in a row.
Indeed.
And we've got lots of science. I wasn't sure. Is that how you say the planet, K2-18b?
Well, your guess is as good as mine on this
right.
one.
Right, we're just saying letters now.
It just does sound like something out of Star Trek, though, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. And dimethyl sulfide. I mean, what's
that's
going
a real
on
name.
Here?
That's
dimethyl
a real
sulfide. Yeah. That sounded real. And are we? What's the significance of this?
Well, those of you who have been paying attention to the news over the past week or so will have seen headlines such as, and I quote, chemical fingerprints could belong to a signature of life on a distant planet, or scientists find promising hints of life on distant planet K2-18b, or scientists find strongest evidence yet of life on alien planet. So they're not sort of beating about the bush on this one.
Yeah, that sounds pretty confident.
That does sound pretty confident, and I'm here to temper that confidence, shall we say.
Oh, we should not be nearly as confident.
Well, I mean, again, depends who you believe on this one, really.
Right.
But, so, yeah, there's been a lot of excitement, I guess, over the past week over the purported signs of life on this exoplanet K2-18b, or hyphen 18b, whatever you want to call it. And this is all due to workers in the UK and the USA. And they have been using the good old James Webb Space Telescope, which was launched, gosh, how many years ago now? Probably 3 years ago now.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
There or thereabouts. Which, you know, which is Hubble's replacement. Hubble's still going. Hubble's still taking amazing photos, but James Webb is just better. And what they have reported is the presence of either or both a thing called dimethyl sulfide or dimethyl disulfide.
Right.
Which is a chemical compound that exists here on Earth. And the big thing is that supposedly the only way that it's made on Earth is biologically. So it's produced by, for example, marine phytoplankton.
Right.
Okay. And it gets up into the atmosphere and then it's relatively short-lived. It sort of lasts a day or something like that, and then it reacts with oxygen, ozone, things like that, and disappears. And so what these workers in the UK and the USA are saying is that, okay, if we're seeing this molecule, and it's a big if, then we're saying that the only possible way and in fact, I quote the authors, the most logical explanation is that the planet is covered with an ocean of warm water that is, quote, teeming with life, unquote.
Wow. That sounds quite confident.
The most logical explanation now.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, this is tough. Okay, so how do they do this, first of all? So they're using the James Webb telescope.
Yeah, but how can you see something like this
there you go.
Through a
there
telescope,
you go. There
right?
you go. That's the question. Okay, how can you even see an exoplanet through a telescope? Okay, so we're talking about a planet that is around about, or a star at least, that's 120 light years away from Earth. Okay, so just to, you know, let you know how far that is. So in every second, light travels 300,000 kilometers. Okay,
yep.
Every second. There's 86,400 seconds in a day, there's 365 days in a year, etc. You know, do you do the multiplication? And you'll find that 120 light years is an awfully, awfully long way away.
Yeah.
And what they are relying on is this planet, which they cannot see. You can see the star, but you can't see the planet.
Right.
And so what happens is the planet's rotating the star, and when it passes in front of the star,
yeah,
as it will in a rotation if we're looking in the right place, the light from the star will dim ever, ever, ever so slightly.
And we'll be able to see it.
And you'll be able to see that dimming. You won't be able to see the planet. You'll be able to see the dimming in the light from the star. And because the light from the star is shining through the atmosphere of this planet, you can, if you're really good, pick up some chemical signals of what's in the atmosphere. Okay. So 120 light years away.
Yeah. Doesn't that also mean this is 120 years in the past?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, yeah. Absolutely is. Yes.
So this
yes.
might all just be gone now as well.
Yeah, it could be. We don't know. We don't know. But so sadly, this all comes down to statistics, okay? Because you're getting a signal. Now, this is a really seriously weak signal, as you can sort of hopefully imagine.
Yeah.
And this very weak signal could be the signal corresponding to dimethyl sulfide and or dimethyl disulfide, or it could just be statistical fluctuations. Okay,
now, so just anything else?
Yeah, just noise, yeah, basically. Yeah, just noise. So the authors are pretty damn confident. They say there's only a 0.3% chance that the signals are spurious. Other people are saying, nah, well, we've had a look at your original data and we reckon that was just noise. Okay.
Right.
And so, as the great man Rutherford once said, if your experiment relies on statistics, you need to design a better experiment, which I always like. But basically what you're going to need here is better data.
Yeah.
And you need to recognize that this dimethyl sulfide, that's not the only possible source of dimethyl sulfide.
It's not a guarantee.
This is the universe we're talking about. There's a hell of a lot we don't know about the universe. And so what we do know is that you can make dimethyl sulfide in the lab abiotically.
Yeah.
Okay. So it doesn't have to involve life. And the dimethyl sulfide has in fact been detected on a lifeless comet, which has the great name 67P/Churyumov-Gerasimenko.
Ah, it just rolls off the tongue.
It doesn't really, does it? So... So if this DMS was the real stuff, then presumably it's going to be relatively short-lived and you'll see the breakdown products from when it decomposes. And they haven't seen those. They know where they should look, but you know, there's no sign of it.
Right.
And the biggest one, apparently, is that there's no sign of water.
Yeah.
So we're working under the assumption that water is vital for life. Certainly
that's
for life
what
as
we've
we know
assumed.
It.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And it may be an assumption. There might be life out there that doesn't need water, but for us, it absolutely does. So if there's no water signatures from this planet, then, you know, chances are that it's probably not life. But there's all sorts of ifs and buts and everything here. And... look, you know, you can't be that certain. And I think this is more of this sort of science by press release sort of thing. So they've published a paper. Now, dare I say, if the paper was massive, if this was really absolutely kosher, true and everything, then it would be published in a big journal like Science or Nature or whatever. It's in a specialist sort of astronomy journal. I would have thought it would have gone to one of the bigger journals if it was as big a thing as they are saying it is. And sort of one of the naysayers, a good quote is, looking for what's biological on Earth isn't a good guide to what might be biological elsewhere, which I think is a good cautionary quote. So, look, you know, they may have discovered something, but... it's certainly not worth the big headlines that it's been getting, you know.
Yeah.
I know they've sort of prefaced it with possible and promising and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, let's maybe wait a wee while before we start saying we've discovered life on an alien planet or whatever. And can we not get a better name than K2-18b, for goodness sake?
Maybe it'll be the other planet with life on it.
the other one. Yes.
Yeah,
there you go.
Moving forward. Yeah. And then what's this about nickel farming? Nickel, I mean, famously a metal, we don't usually farm those.
We don't. And normally, if we want nickel, we mine it out of the ground. So I think New Caledonia, for example, has got the world's biggest nickel mine. I'm pretty sure they've got a whopper up there. And that's the same as any metal, really. If we want any metal out of the ground, then the way we do it is dig it up. That's our good old human way, and it's the most effective way. Sadly, it's not ecologically brilliant. But the question then becomes, is mining the only way of doing this? Is digging holes and everything the only way of getting metals out of the ground? And the answer is, in fact, not.
No.
And this is very interesting because nickel is becoming ever more important as a component of EV batteries.
Right.
So, you know, battery technology is advancing and we know that we need all of these metals from the Earth's crust. So how how else could we do that rather than digging things up? So we go to Albania.
Albania.
I've been to Albania.
Oh, that sounds
Albania is nice. An amazing place. Mm. Oh, yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. If you want a fabulous cheap holiday on gorgeous turquoise beaches and stuff like that, Albania is your place. Just watch the roads. Just getting two punctures in one day is not good.
Unfortunate.
Yeah. Anyway, so apparently the soils in Albania, about 11% of the soils in Albania are sort of useless for growing sort of food crops and stuff because they are very high in metals.
Right.
Okay. And in particular, nickel. So they've got high nickel content, and but there's one plant that seems to thrive there in these soils that have high nickel content. And this is going to roll off the tongue again as well. So it's called Odontarina chalcidica. That's all my genus and species.
Do we know any similar plants that might resemble it? Or
It's yellow. There
it's
you go.
Yellow. It's yellow. Got it.
You can guess I'm not a botanist, you know. It's yellow. But apparently this particular plant thrives in these soils. And it turns out that it is what is called a nickel hyperaccumulator. And it can actually concentrate nickel. It can pull nickel out of the soil and into its roots and leaves. And that's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And even more so, that nickel can constitute 2%, up to 2% of the dry weight of the plant.
That's quite a lot.
That
I'd imagine.
A hell of a lot.
Yeah, especially dry weight, right? Because I'd imagine most of a plant's weight is water.
Mm. So that, you know, is quite astonishing. Mm. How does it do that and not get poisoned by the nickel? You know, why does it thrive where other plants can't grow? Don't know the answer to that. As I say, what we do know is that you can get up to 2%. And so, therefore, if you look at this plant now, another thing about this plant, it's very high yield and it's very fast growing.
Mm.
So here's the kicker. So from one growing season, from 1 hectare, from every hectare, you can get 200 to 400 kilograms of nickel.
That, I'd imagine, is quite a significant amount.
That's a decent whack.
Yeah.
You know, and you do it all without
mining.
Touching the environment, basically.
Yeah.
Now, what you have to do to get it out is to burn the plant, okay?
Mm.
And then you end up sort of with the nickel residues, which you can extract and everything. But this company over in the States, who are collaborating with these Albanians, have found a method by which this extraction can now be carbon negative, not just carbon neutral, but carbon negative.
So that's quite good.
Which is pretty stunning and everything. So this is a thing called phytomining, which I must admit I really was not familiar with until I found this while thumbing through all of the news stories and everything. And it's fabulous. So this has been known for quite some time, in fact, that there are plants that can do this. And apparently in the 80s, they were looking at this in America, and they stopped the trial because the plant ran the risk of being an invasive species. So it was just, you know, it was going everywhere and everything.
Too successful.
We're going to kill this. But what they are now talking about is genetically modifying the plant.
That was my thought as well,
so that it can't actually, you know, just get out there and spread uncontrollably. So this sounds really, really seriously promising.
Yeah, very exciting stuff.
Fascinating story, yeah.
And then lastly here, turning rainfall into electricity. How are we doing that?
Well, normally turning rainfall into electricity involves the turning of very, very large turbines, doesn't it?
Well, that's what I'd imagine.
Hydroelectric, you know, all that. And that's certainly turning rainfall into electricity. But it turns out you don't need the turbines, which, again, to me seems utterly, utterly bizarre. So there are these workers in Singapore, and what they do, quite simply, and this is as simple as you can get, is they take rainwater and they just let rainwater trickle through little tubes, and these tubes are about a couple of millimetres in diameter and about 30 centimetres long. They let the rainfall trickle through these, and the trick, no pun intended, is that they go in sort of spurts. So they have droplets of water that are separated by air pockets.
Right.
Okay, so it's not a continuous stream.
Yeah,
it's droplet, air pocket, droplet, blah, 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 blah. And they call this plug flow. This is this type of flow.
Right.
Now, you know when you rub a balloon on your arm, something like that, and it attracts your
hair. Bit of static electricity.
Okay. Yeah. So similar sort of thing happens when water flows on or through particular substances. Okay, you get charge separation, and whenever you get charge separation, you can get flow of electrons, you can get electricity. Okay, and this is what happens with water in these little tubes. Just simply the water, just the act of water flowing through the tubes with these air pockets in between these plugs of water.
It sounds too simple to be true.
Well, it is. And so what they found, they could light 12 LEDs for 20 seconds just using these small tubes.
Hmm.
Okay, so they're getting generation of electricity just from the flow of water. And they tried hot water, they tried cold water, they tried salt water, they tried all sorts of water. It all works.
Wow.
And they were getting about a 10% energy conversion.
Hmm.
Okay.
Just I don't know how good a 10% energy conversion rate is.
Well, hell, it's better than zero. And if you're getting this just from the flow of water through tubes, you don't need any special equipment or anything.
No, I'd imagine you could put those on every building everywhere.
You just need a wire at the top and the wire at the bottom, and there's a circuit. And this to me is utterly, utterly, utterly astonishing. And I'll be really, really interested to see where this goes.
Yeah.
Just quite extraordinary stuff.
Mm.
Now, this, by contrast, was published in a very good journal.
Right.
So, you know.
So we can say this is promising research with some validity behind.
That's what you normally assume. Yeah. Now, that's not necessarily always the case.
Right. Yeah, we did cover a while ago where there was a story of a science published article that was debunked.
Oh, yes, indeed. You know, that can happen. Mm. But more often than not, if you see something in a very good journal, chances are it's good science.
Very interesting.
Yeah, there's the world's energy problem solved in a stroke, you know. Incredible.
Yeah, and lots of stories for us to keep watching out for.
Absolutely.
New life on a planet, maybe some metal farms with plants, and of course rain turning into electricity.
And remember, you heard it here first on BFM.
Yeah, you heard it here first on BFM's Dear Science. All right, well, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Motat.
Yeah, thank you for coming in. Thank you, Motat. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.